The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show. On Relevant Radio.
Cubans are worthy and ready to rule themselves without tyranny. It can end today, and it must end today.
Yeah, that was Miami Mayor Francis Suarez reacting to the protest in Cuba. We'll talk more about that coming up. His Excellency Archbishop Thomas Wenske from Miami will be stopping by a little later this hour. A call for our Cuban brothers and sisters, especially those who are seriously oppressed. Let's pray for those who have a lot less than us. I mean, we take a lot for granted here in the States. We have a lot of freedoms. And we've been blessed as a nation. There's no doubt about that. So big development there. We'll see what comes from it, if anything at all. But if you've missed that story or you've only seen a little bit of it, I'll bring you up to speed on what's happening. I hope you're well. I hope you are staying healthy. Over the last few months, the number of COVID cases have fallen pretty well in our country, so much that there's no longer, of course, the national mask mandate that we have. But those downward trends, and here's what I'm seeing, they're starting to reverse. And what we're hearing right now from officials is that there's actually a slight upward spike happening right now. And that's according to a very reputable source. That's Johns Hopkins University. And they're blaming it, of course, on the Delta variant. We've been talking about that in recent days. And we're going to see more of the CDC. In fact, well, Pfizer's been asking or suggesting a booster. I don't know what vaccine you have, whether you have the J&J or whether you had the, the Pfizer or the Moderna, or whether you're waiting for the Novavax. New daily cases topped 20,000 for the third day in a row on Friday, and it's something which has not happened since earlier in the year. So new cases are up right now. They're up about 46% from 2 weeks ago. Hospitalizations, too, they're on the rise. They're up 11%. But apparently the two states that are getting hit the hardest, guess where they are? And it's not New York, and it's not California. No, it's not Chicago either. Arkansas and Missouri. So as we head into the fall, experts are very concerned that those numbers are going to continue to rise, they say, especially for the unvaccinated. And there are a large portion of the population that has still chosen not to be vaccinated. But they're on the rise, as I said, largely driven by this Delta variant. We're seeing lots of different variants. NBC was reporting on what they're seeing. And I'll get you plugged in. Listen to this report.
In the U.S., coronavirus cases are climbing more than two dozen states, the dominant strain fueling outbreaks in Arkansas, Missouri, Nevada, and Texas.
We're going to overwhelm the healthcare system here in Arkansas within the next 14 days.
The U.S. Surgeon General stressing the risks of going unvaccinated.
We're seeing now are the vast, vast majority of them, more than 99%, are in unvaccinated populations.
The deadly surge, largely driven by the Delta variant.
So Pfizer is saying, okay, you know what? If you have already had your two jabs, you might need a third. They want a booster shot to be given. A lot of people are saying, well, really, do we need it? The CDC and the FDA are telling Pfizer, Americans don't need that booster shot right now. Pfizer is insisting that the booster shots are needed. We'll see how it ultimately plays out. To me, I just sit back, and maybe I'm a little skeptical, but I'm thinking, how good for the bottom line, especially if you own Pfizer stock, right? You've gotten two jabs already, and now you need a third. Millions have taken the COVID vaccine. What about Pfizer's third booster? What does the CDC have to say about it? Here's a report from Reuters. Listen.
Pfizer said on Sunday that it will meet with federal health officials as soon as Monday to discuss the need for a third booster shot of the coronavirus vaccine. The meeting comes days after the vaccine maker and its partner, BioNTech, announced plans to seek U.S. and European regulatory approval for a third dose of their COVID-19 shot amid the spread of variants and data they said showed heightened risk of infection 6 months after initial inoculation. That push prompted a quick response from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying Americans do not need a booster right now. President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, Anthony Fauci, who also directs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, will be among those invited to the briefing. On Sunday, Fauci said U.S. health officials were not dismissing the possible future need for boosters, but that more data is needed for any formal recommendation.
Well, certainly it is entirely conceivable, maybe likely, that at some time we will need a boost. It may be differentially needed depending upon the age of individuals and their underlying conditions. Now, right now, what the CDC and the FDA said in a joint statement is that at this time, we don't see the need for it.
U.S. health officials are still struggling to get people in some areas to receive their initial inoculations as the highly contagious Delta variant has grown to be the nation's dominant strain, with COVID-19 cases rising mostly among the unvaccinated.
So the FDA has given Johnson & Johnson's vaccine another kick in the pants, too. I mean, they've actually said that the vaccine can make people susceptible to nerve disorder. There is that, what's the name of that that syndrome? Is it Guillain-Barré, I think? I think that was it, or something along those lines. That's the last thing that you're going to want to get, right? So FDA warning about that. I have some problems with the J&J vaccine just personally, but we'll see. There's a lot of developments still coming. In Kentucky, there's a lawsuit right now from prisoners who have hepatitis C, and they want to get the treatment for the disease, and the treatment is not cheap. It's anywhere from $13,000 to $32,000 per person. The question is it effective? The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals actually denied a prisoner's request for this treatment, saying that the state is just fine denying it because of the costs. And I think that should give a lot of people pause. I mean, prisoners being denied medical treatment, I know some people may disagree with me on this particular point, because of costs. Now, there's some serious problems there because people who are imprisoned, just because you're incarcerated, you should not be denied medical treatment. You know, you should not be denied that medical treatment because of the cost. And you got to wonder if this person has been, you know, if they had requested a sex change treatment like we've talked about, if the court would have ruled the same way. It seems to have a different view when it comes to sexual identity, right, than fighting hepatitis C. It's just so strange, isn't it, the times we live in, you know, how people view things, what's good on one side of the equation is not on the other. You know, President Biden actually also making news. He signed an executive order on Friday. He cracked down on monopolies that make up big tech. And CNBC reported that, you know, this sweeping order, which includes about 72 actions and recommendations, it involves a dozen, I think, different federal agencies. They're intended to reshape the thinking around corporate consolidations and antitrust laws. Biden administration laid out the case. They said that the biggest companies in the tech sector, they're wielding their power to box out smaller competitors and exploit consumers' personal information. Biden issued this executive order. Listen to the report from CNBC.
President Biden made the case that growing corporate consolidation is bad for consumers, not just because it leads to higher prices, but also lower wages, less job mobility, and fewer small businesses.
I know America can't succeed unless American business succeeds. But let me be very clear. Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation.
The executive order that he signed spans more than a dozen federal agencies. There are 72 actions or recommendations targeting, as Biden put it, big ag, big pharma, and big tech. It also calls on the FTC and the DOJ to ramp up their scrutiny of future mergers and to go back and look for bad ones that may have already happened. Now, the business community, though, is sounding the alarm over the administration's move. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is disputing the idea that there are too many businesses that are too big. And guys, they call this executive order a government knows best approach.
All right, so we'll see how all that shakes out, what it does for competition. That's just some of your headlines today. A lot more I can get into with you a little bit later. But one of the big stories over the weekend was what we saw in the streets of Havana and what we saw in the streets here of the United States. Cuba's been under a communist regime for, what, the last 60, 62 years? And every so often there have been these uprisings because of the repression that the government imposes. And some people in the here in the U.S., they like to go to Havana. If you ever go over there to see, the cars are old, they're from the 50s and the 60s. A beautiful country, looks kind of picturesque. But the reason they have so many old cars is because people there don't have access to new ones. The government will not allow any private, industry on the island, and they don't allow imports. And even if they did, the people probably wouldn't be able to afford them because of their impoverished conditions. Just one indicator of how bad their situation is, right? I mean, there's been food shortages, all sorts of problems. Here's one other. The government isn't doing anything to treat COVID-19. And they're also not treating other diseases that can be easily taken care of with basic drugs. There's a disease caused by mites called scabies, and that's running rampant through the island right now, along with COVID. I had heard one report, I think there were 7,000 cases just recently reported. But so the people had enough. They took to the streets yesterday to protest. And these protests are also spurring reaction here in the States, especially in Little Havana. CBS Miami was there, and they'll give you a look.
Well into the night, the streets of Calle Ocho were still packed, with hundreds in Miami on Sunday calling for change in Cuba, yelling chants of freedom for the Cuban people.
Cuba libre! The lack of food, they are under hunger, they are suffering so much, and they're tired.
The protest in Miami, a moment of solidarity with people on the island and an uprising decades in the making. This video from Havana shows people flooding the streets of Cuba, demanding food and vaccines as COVID-19 cases soar and calling for the end of decades of dictatorship.
For this to happen, they have to have reached a moment of desperation that is so bad that they're willing to risk their lives. And for that, we have to support them.
In Miami on Sunday, the streets of Little Havana were filled with people, many of whom fled communist Cuba, like Andrew Suarez.
I'm actually more emotional by the fact that I'm seeing this happening in Cuba, because that's something very, very difficult. We could do this. We live in freedom.
Yeah, we take freedom for granted here in the States, don't we? Those who don't have it understand how precious it is. The Miami mayor, Francis Suarez, also called for the U.S. intervention and spoke of how repressive the government there has been. I'm going to be joined by His Excellency Archbishop Thomas Wenske coming up in just a moment. But before I do, let me share with you some of what the mayor had to say. Here's some of his comments yesterday.
The regime must end now. It is not negotiable. The Cuban people on the streets are demanding the end of the regime, and we must not betray them. We ask the National Police and the armed forces in Cuba to support the people, as the police appear to be doing. We ask for an international intervention led by the United States to protect the Cuban people from a bloodbath. I have been in contact with the U.S. Department of State, and they are monitoring the peaceful protests in Cuba. We are asking Miamians to peacefully protest and to avoid any incidents of violence, and are urging them to understand that there may be provocateurs from the Castro regime who may be looking to create confrontations. Today is the day, and the eyes of the world are on Cuba. The world now can see clearly the true face of the Cuban government and how it has systematically repressed, killed, and starved its people in the name of a failed ideology. Cubans are worthy and ready to rule themselves without tyranny. It can end today, and it must end today. I want to pray for all of the Cubans in Cuba right now. I want to tell them directly that we are with them, that we are completely united in the effort for them to have freedom, what we all desire as human beings. And I ask God to protect them in a horrible situation where we know it's possible that the Cuban government will try to stifle this spontaneous island-wide movement.
You know that that is the case, right? This is not something that happens often in communist countries. But you heard the repression, the starvation, the oppression that the Cuban people have gone through. And apparently they're fed up. They're so fed up that they're actually carrying American flags in the streets during their protests. And that was the mayor, of course, of Miami there asking for support. Archbishop Thomas Wenske is the Archbishop of Miami, home of the largest population of Cubans outside of Cuba. And he joins us today. Your Excellency, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much. That protest is getting the world's attention. It seems to have just popped up out of the blue. Can you fill us in? What triggered this? What set it off?
Well, you know, of course, the Cuban people are frustrated over the extended lockdown because of COVID, but that is also the case with Cuba's neighbors and the rest of the world. But besides COVID, the Cuban population has suffered from a series of deprivations, the lack of basic freedoms, the lack of food, the lack of prospects for the future. And so, you know, these demonstrations were an expression of the legitimate frustrations of the Cuban people.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, it appears that the government has chosen to respond with repressive actions and a discourse that threatens further violence against those who, you know, seek simply a better future for their country.
Yep.
But it is a heartening sign that the people are willing to express themselves and that they are losing the fear that has basically kept them in check for many, many decades.
Yeah, Your Excellency, I understand that they were carrying an image of Our Lady through the streets. What was the image? And let's talk about that. Why is that so significant?
Probably Our Lady of Nuestra Señora de Caridad, Our Lady of Charity, which is the patroness of Cuba, and it's a symbol not only of Cuban religiosity but also of Cuban patriotism, and so. Her image was in those manifestations was no surprise. And, you know, the Cuban freedom fighters that fought against Spain for their independence referred to her as the Virgen Mambisa.
Wow.
Mambisa meaning one of those, you know, freedom fighters. So,
yeah.
Our Lady of Charity has always been identified with the aspirations of the Cuban people for freedom and for their independence. And because of that freedom and independence, I don't think anybody really would welcome American intervention in Cuba.
Right.
So I think perhaps the mayor of Miami got his emotions got a little bit ahead of him in calling for U.S. intervention, because that would almost give legitimacy to the Cuban government's claim that this was all being orchestrated by people in Miami. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, no, Cuba's president is blaming the U.S. for the unrest, saying that the economic sanctions have been too harsh.
Yeah,
is there any truth to that?
Well, economic sanctions have been harsh, and certainly in the past several years, partly because of COVID, but also partly because of the tightening up of measures by the Trump administration that revoked some of the easing of measures done by the Obama administration, has inflicted some economic pain on Cuba. But the embargo, the United States embargo, it does inflict some pain, and it inflicts pain on the people least guilty, because it hurts the poorest rather than, you know, the communist leaders have ways of getting around the embargo. But it doesn't explain the misery of the Cuban people fully, because there is an internal embargo in Cuba, which is imposed by the inefficient and unworkable communist economy.
Yeah. What have you heard, Your Excellency, from Cuban exiles who have come most recently from the island? What picture do they paint, and what are they telling you?
Well, I was in Cuba just before the coronavirus, so I have, you know, kind of a firsthand experience of Cuba myself, it is a difficult situation, and people are, you know, are hoping for change, but they also are very, cautious, because they certainly wanted the change for the better and not for the worse. And as bad as things are, they could always become worse. And we've seen that in Haiti, for example. Mm-hmm. So, the situation is difficult. Cuba, the Cuban government has a tight grip on security in the country. So in that sense, you know, this is a totalitarian government, they are able to stifle dissent.
To that point,
which is why perhaps this frightened them so much.
Right. So there have been protests in the past, Your Excellency. They've always amounted to nothing. Is this different?
Well, in the past, the last big protest in Cuba was in, I think, 1993 or 92, and it had something similar in Havana, where people ran out in the streets, you know, yelling freedom, and that was because in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, the subsidies that kept Cuba afloat had come to an end, and there was a similar period of great deprivation and hunger, and dissent has been pretty well tamped down in Cuba. Now, dissent is not enough to necessarily to change governments. In Haiti, for example, the Haitian people, the Haitian civil society, opposition groups have been demonstrating almost weekly for almost a year and a half against the government, whose president was assassinated last week, but without effectively moving that government to listen to them and to heed their cries for justice. So the Cuban government is not going to necessarily fold because of one day's protest.
Of course,
unfortunately, we could hope that it would disappear like a magic wand and make all that pain and go away, but it's going to take a long time. And really, this, I think, the church in Cuba has been, long preaching reconciliation and seeing that as a necessary part of any transition that would bring about a soft landing rather than a hard landing.
Well, Your Excellency, I want to thank you for your time, and especially for your leadership. It's great to have you here and have your perspective. We'll pray for our brothers and sisters in Cuba. We'll pray for you, and please do the same for us, okay?
And pray for the people in Haiti as well, because they're going through a very similar and perhaps even more dire situation right now.
And so true. Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, and boy, the turmoil and suffering that those people are seeing. Quite profound. Thank you. That's His Excellency Archbishop Thomas Wenske. He is the Archbishop of Miami, home to the largest populations of Cubans outside of Cuba. I'll be back with more. Stay with me.
It was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade.
The issues that matter most.
Actively engaged in terrorism.
Right here.
Make America moral again.
The Drew Mariani Show is live on Relevant Radio.
Coming up in about 30 minutes, we will pray the chaplet. Good afternoon. Let's pray for the people in Cuba. Let's pray for our country as well. I saw a stunning photograph over the weekend of Lake Mead and how low it has dropped. If I get a chance, I'm going to try to post it on social media because it was breathtaking. And I just think of what's happening in our country right now. I mean, the West is baking, right? If you are listening right now in the West, you know how hot it is. Fires are raging. There's triple-digit temperatures right now. And a large swath of the West right now, it baked during the weekend. We're dealing with can you imagine triple-digit temperatures? And they're expected to continue all the way into the start of this work week. An excessive heat warning remains in place for Death Valley. Check these temperatures out. I mean, I can't get my head around them because they're so hot. Temperatures in Death Valley, they expect to go to 125 to 130 degrees. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. The area's daily record high is about 129. The world's record high is 134. So we are getting into that territory. And amidst all the heat, wildfires continue to burn a lot of the western U.S. Multiple fires continue to devour acres, just blazing across six states as of late yesterday. And the largest of the blazes is the Bootleg Fire. It burned, I think 143,000 plus acres in Oregon. And then you've got the other ones, too. You got the Beckwith Complex Fire. It's 134 square miles. It's raging near California's border with Nevada. It was 20% contained. You probably heard the story over the weekend of the firefighter that died after a plane responding to the wildfire crashed on Saturday. So let's remember these people as well. But extreme heat is gripping the West. It's caused fires to continue to tear through land. Take a listen to this report. It'll give you a better picture.
Tonight, extreme temperatures fueling infernos across the West. In California, more than twice as many acres have burned compared to the same time last year, triggering evacuations in the northern part of the state. The Beckwith Complex fire this weekend doubling in size. Photographer Craig Philpott captured the intense conditions as a small town burned.
It's just weeks and weeks and weeks drier than it should be this time of year.
The fire season, not only prematurely ferocious, but also deadly. In Arizona, retired fire chief Jeff Pachura and pilot Matthew Miller were killed in an air accident. The scorching temperatures threatening nearly 30 million Americans across the West, with thermostats soaring 10 to 20 degrees above average.
Miserable.
On Saturday, Utah tied its all-time hottest statewide record, a sizzling 117 in St. George, the same temperature as Las Vegas, also matching a Sin City record.
You're in an oven.
The extreme heat pushing the region's extreme drought to historic levels, reducing water deliveries across the West, with reservoirs hitting new lows. In Utah, one reservoir has completely run dry.
This year is something different. This is something I've never seen before.
Yeah, coming up in just a moment or two, Dr. Roy Spencer is going to be joining us. We'll get his perspective on what we're seeing in terms of these reservoirs. You know, people living in the western part of the country, especially those in the Southwest, have always had to deal with, you know, getting water. It's just a dry part of the country. And the main reason why agriculture has been able to be done in places like Arizona and Southern California is because of irrigation, with you know, most of that water coming from the Colorado River. The Hoover Dam, which is situated between the Arizona and the Nevada borders on the Colorado, it was put there to be able to help control the river's waters and help with the irrigation of the area. It was built, you know, during the Depression. It is really a monumental feat if you think about it. That was built in about 60 months. About 5 years, they built that wonder. Very impressive for such a huge undertaking. Think of the time that they did this. The dam backed up the waters of the river and it created what is called Lake Mead. But Lake Mead's water level is drastically low. As I said, I saw an image of where the tub line was. There was a boat in this lake. You cannot believe how far it dropped. If I get a chance, I'll try to put it up on Twitter. But with the dropping water levels, you have to think, what are the ramifications? CBS News took a look at that. Check this out.
Man, it's amazing to see it up close.
For more than eight decades, the Hoover Dam has relied on water from Nevada's Lake Mead to cover up its backside. But now at age 85, it finds itself uncomfortably exposed. Much of the water the dam is supposed to be holding back is gone.
This is like a different world.
Pat Mulroy is the former head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. She says Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir, is on track to soon hit its lowest level ever recorded. This part of the Colorado River system is a crucial water supply for Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Southern California. It makes the vast agricultural land of the desert Southwest possible.
This landscape screams problems to me. I mean, just look at the bathtub rings. To me, that is an enormous wake-up call.
Lake Mead is at just 37% of its capacity. It hasn't been full since back in 2000, when the water came right up to the top of Hoover Dam. This is what it looks like now.
Since 2000, Lake Mead has dropped 130 feet. That's hard to imagine, but picture a 13-story building on top of my head, and way up there, that's where the water used to be. So you and I talked here back in 2014.
We did.
At that time, I asked you, how critical a point are we at?
It's a pretty critical point.
If you look at 30 feet lower now, what point are we at?
We're at a tipping point. It's an existential issue for Arizona, for California, for Nevada. It is just that simple.
For the first time ever, the federal government is expected to declare a water shortage on the lower Colorado River later this summer. That will force automatic cuts to the water supply for Nevada and Arizona starting in 2022.
So it's a serious situation. There's this ongoing drought in that area of the country, and even more than unusual, the lake and the river are drying up. And ever since, you know, 1983, the water level has dropped 152 feet. In this one piece I read today, everybody's saying it's climate change, climate change, climate change. Is that true? We'll find out in a minute. As I said, Dr. Spencer will give us his perspective. But according to the LA Times, you know, with these soaring temperatures we're seeing, the water in the lake has been dropping by a foot a week. I mean, not a month, not a year, a foot a week. Think about that. In fact, you can see what they're calling this bathtub ring around the lake. It's a calcium deposit that's left behind when the water drops. It's an amazing shot. And as I said, I'm busy doing the broadcast, but if I get a chance after the show, I'll try to put it up there for you. So check us out at Drew Mariani Show on Twitter or Facebook. Of course, look, this isn't just evaporation, right? It's the amount of water also being used by people downstream. Next month, according to the Times, the federal government expects to declare its first ever shortage on the lake, and that's going to trigger cuts to water that's delivered to Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico, right? New Mexico, and on January 1st. And if the lake currently drops, they say, you know, 28 more feet, the spigot of water to California is going to start to tighten in 2023. You're looking at a matter of months. So this is going to have ramifications. Has this happened before? Is it cyclical? Is it climate change? Or do we need some monsoons? What do we need? Dr. Roy Spencer is a meteorologist and a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. It's good to have him here with us. He's worked at NASA as a senior scientist for climate studies. And I hope you'll check him out at his website, drroyspencer.com. That's drroyspencer.com. Doctor, good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. Good to be with you again.
I'm delighted to have you here. When I realized you were on the show with me tonight, I thought, wow, perfect person to talk about everything from the temperatures to the dropping water levels. I love your take on what you're seeing. And I was reading earlier today, one person that was interviewed by the Times said that it isn't really a drought because of how long it's gone on. It's kind of an aridification, I think is what he called it. What do you see happening? What's going on? How do you read this?
Well, in the big picture, this time of year out west, it's always a drought, you know?
Right.
And we've got tens of millions of people that have decided to live in an area that has this seasonal drought, which is why they had to build reservoirs. Remember, these are not natural lakes. These were, you know, mankind intervening in nature in order to meet mankind's water needs. So out west, you don't have as many lakes as you have these reservoirs as a result of damming up of rivers, okay? So Lake Mead, it's been dropping over the last, since 2000, partly due to reduced rainfall, partly due to increased usage of the available water. I remember years ago, I gave a talk out in Las Vegas at a meeting of a whole bunch of representatives from different states where they get together every year and they talk about how they're going to apportion this water. And it was so foreign to me because I live in Alabama, where there's always enough water for everyone, and the excess drains out the rivers and goes into the Gulf of Mexico, you know. There's never a water shortage here. So it was just really weird to me that it's such a big deal out west. But of course it is, because, you know, life, you know, requires water, right?
Right.
Now, what's also interesting to me, as I was listening to your coverage, your news coverage of Lake Mead there, was I'm from the shores of Lake Superior, okay? One of the largest freshwater bodies in the world. It along with Lake Baikal in Russia. And for a lot of years, the water level in Lake Superior was falling. And of course it was, you know, oh, it's human caused climate change. And then all of a sudden it reversed. And for the last, 4 or 5 years, people are screaming because the water levels in Lake Superior are so high now that it's eroding the coastline. Right. And you got cabins or houses that are falling into the lake because of erosion from the high water levels. And they can't let the water out of Lake Superior fast enough because the lower lakes are high too. And these are huge bodies of fresh water compared to the man-made Lake Mead. So, you know, there's natural climate variations, there's natural weather variations. This too shall change, although the West is always going to be at risk because you got tens of millions of people that want to live where there is naturally very little water.
Right. Hey, speaking of the Great Lakes, though, because I know past few years, Lake Michigan, a lot of Chicago residents and others in Wisconsin and Michigan bordering that lake, saw the water levels rise drastically, and now I think they are going back down again. Is this rise and fall in water in the Great Lakes just cyclical? Is it related to weather and to temperatures? You know, what are you seeing? Because I know that this year, water levels are considerably lower than they were, let's say, last year when docks were, you know, practically underwater.
It's mainly related to weather. And it has to do with precipitation and evaporation patterns. So, for instance, excessive precipitation in the drainage basin around the Great Lakes is going to raise the water level. But 4 or 5 years ago, one of the things that raised it even more was how cold the winter was. Whoa. The winter was so cold that virtually all of Lake Superior froze over and much of the lower lakes froze over. And when that happens, it reduces the evaporation that naturally occurs, which is, you know, a loss of moisture from the lakes. And that was shut off. And as a result, the lakes rose even higher, and that was because of unusually cold weather.
Wow, fascinating. Now, you know, what we're seeing here with Lake Mead and out west, it's being blamed, of course, on man-made global warming. Is that the case, or is this just what naturally happens in that area of the country? Well, some of the numbers I was reading are pretty dramatic earlier today, but what are you reading about the unusually high temperatures that we're seeing now and the direct correlation of what we're seeing in terms of water level?
Well, in the big picture, the Western U.S., they know from tree ring studies, has experienced periods of much more extensive drought over the last 1 to 2,000 years. Than we've seen recently. In recent centuries, it's actually been a somewhat wetter and cooler period in the Western U.S.
Wow.
So there's no way to know whether we're going back towards a more natural, drier period in the West.
Right.
We really don't know. It doesn't make sense to blame it on human-caused climate change because, and this is something I encourage your listeners to look up, Cliff Mass Weather Blog, Cliff Mass, M-A-S-S, is at the University of Washington. He knows more about this stuff than anybody. He's a meteorologist, atmospheric scientist, who is an expert, has published papers on heat waves in the West, especially the Pacific Northwest, since he's in Seattle. And he has a lot of good information on this. And he's not a global warming denier. He just wants people to be honest about what's causing what. and for instance, this recent heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. It's very localized. It was localized to British Columbia, Alberta, state of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, basically. If you look at the bigger area all around North America, there has been unusual coolness below normal temperatures through much of the southern and the southeastern U.S. And if you average it all together, for instance, over the last 3 weeks, it's been, say, at least 10 degrees above normal in those areas around the Pacific Northwest. But the whole area averages only half a degree Fahrenheit above normal. And why is that? It's because there's cool areas that go along with the warm area. These are weather patterns. There's been a very strong high pressure ridge over the Pacific Northwest, and it was a combination of just certain things that caused that very strong heat wave.
Well, Dr. Spencer, stay with me if you could for a second. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll talk more, taking a look at the weather. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get connected. Get a 360-degree look at all the news and issues of the day right now. This is the Drew Mariani Show. Getting you connected on Relevant Radio.
All right, so good being with you. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. If you are just getting plugged in, we're taking a look at, Lake Mead and water levels dropping, temperatures raging. We've got a western drought underway. And I've invited to join us today for just clarity and perspective and expertise, a very gifted meteorologist, Dr. Roy Spencer. As I said, he worked at NASA as a senior scientist for climate studies. He has a website. You should check that out. It's drroyspencer.com, drroyspencer.com. And if you want to join us, I literally only have him for a few moments. You can get in at 888-914-9149. And Doctor, I am grateful for your time, especially for your expertise. You know, you talked about tree rings and these cycles of weather. We hear so much about man-made climate change. And I'm one of these people who, I just want the truth. If it's man-made, then let's remedy it. If this is a result of solar activity or something cyclical in nature, let's better understand that so we can prepare for what looms in the future and not necessarily have to change certain policies or do other things. Apparently, last month was the hottest June ever on record. And when I say that, I want to put a little asterisk there because I know our records only go back to the late 1800s. I think the oldest weather records kept in Armagh, Ireland. Is that long enough perspective to say those temperatures really are that remarkable? I mean, how do we look at the weather we're in right now? I know Greenland was green in the 1300s. Weather changes. How are you reading where we are right now, and what contribution do you think mankind is making to this?
Well, there's no question that globally we're in a warm period. The warmth we had in June in the United States, which is less than 2% of the surface area of the Earth, it was supposedly a record warm June from the surface observations, and our satellite temperature data set, which measures a deeper layer of the atmosphere, was the second warmest June. So basically, yeah, it was a very warm June, but not everywhere. It was mainly in the west, in the northwest, that area of enhanced heat in the North Pacific Northwest more than outweighed below normal temperatures in the southern U.S. and the southeastern U.S. And still resulted in a record June, at least in the surface air temperatures. Now, that's mainly a weather thing. Now, at the same time, I believe that human CO2 emissions are causing some of the recent warming. We don't know how much. We've talked about this before, and that's worth a radio segment all its own to discuss why it's so uncertain. Some scientists are virtually certain that all of the recent warming is due to humans, and I consider that a matter of faith. Drew, you said you just want to know the truth. Well, I'm sorry, this is science. This isn't truth. You know, we don't know what the truth is.
Right.
We have observations, we have theories, and it's very difficult sometimes to discern cause and effect. And the main reason I give to people why it's so uncertain is the global energy imbalance, which is associated with recent warming. And we get this from how much the oceans, the deep oceans, have warmed. That's sort of our best estimate of what the global energy imbalance is. That global energy imbalance is about one part in 300 over the recent, like, last 30 years of ocean warming. We don't know any of the natural energy flows in the climate system to that level of accuracy. None of them.
Wow.
The theory that it's all due to humans is based on the assumption that nature is always in balance. That nature, if humans were not around, would always have, you know, we'd always have the same long-term temperatures on the Earth. Well, we know that isn't the truth, okay? We have a lot of, at least anecdotal evidence. There really was a medieval warm period. There really was a Roman warm period. Right. But it's all anecdotal, you know? We don't have thermometer measurements from back then. So a lot of this is based on faith. But I think that the science is pretty sound that at least some of the warming, recent warming, is due to our CO2 emissions. But I don't consider that a bad thing. We've got greening of planet Earth now because of all of the CO2, which is necessary for life to exist on Earth. And warmer, a little warmer anyway, is actually better for humans because cold weather deaths still outnumber hot weather deaths globally by about a factor of 10 to 1.
Wow, absolutely amazing. My guest today, Dr. Rory Spencer. Doctor, I want to thank you for your time. I wish we had a little bit more of it. If people want to follow you, best way is just your website, I'm assuming, Dr. Rory Spencer? Or
Sure, drroyspencer.com.
All right, sounds great. Hey, let's catch up again. I know this story is not going to be going away. We'll have a lot more to talk about, I'm sure, in the days ahead. But thank you for making time for us today, and look forward to our next time.
Well, good to be with you again, Drew.
All right, that's Dr. Roy Spencer. It is a fascinating subject, to say the least. I love what he had to say about the weather records, the warming cycles in the Roman period, the Middle Ages, and where we are right now. Just from a spiritual perspective, I think of a couple different things. One, I remember I've prayed at and visited a site in France. It's way high up in these majestic French Alps. And back in 1846, the Blessed Mother appeared to two children. And they were tending their sheep, and they saw this woman in a circular globe of light. And in it, they saw this woman crying. And the young boy ran up to him. His name was Maximum Gerard. And he thought that, you know, the woman was crying because she was in a fight with her husband or something happened. And as he approached, he realized it was the Mother of God. And it's one of the few apparitions where the Blessed Mother actually came crying. She gave to each child a secret. The other child was a young girl named Melanie Calvet. And they kept these secrets. They gave them to the Pope, actually. But they warned of a great blight that would take place on the potatoes. There would be a great famine. She warned of all the things that were going to happen in the not-too-distant future if people did not return to God. And everything the Virgin warned took place. We saw the great potato famine. 1 million people lost their lives due to the wheat shortage in France. We saw, you know, this exodus from Ireland and immigration into the U.S. But there was an aspect of this apparition, too, which really is, I think, fascinating. Pope Pius IX, he was the Pope at the time. People would always ask him, what's the secret? He says, do you want to know the secret of La Salette? He says, unless you do penance, unless you convert, you will perish. The kids gave him a secret, gave him several secrets. And after reading them, Pius sent gifts and blessings to both of these kids and left the discernment in the hands of the local bishop, who ruled, by the way, positively on the authenticity of the apparitions, right? Although not on the individual secrets. I want to be clear about that. But one of the things that the kids were told by the Virgin Mary was that the seasons will be altered. And I look at our own time. You know, are we experiencing altered seasons? She says there would be infectious disease. Well, clearly, you know, this was before the pandemic of 1908. Of course, we're seeing one now 100 years later as well, that there would be wars. And true to that prophecy, we saw the Great War of World War I, World War II. We saw wars across the 20th century. There'd be plagues. But she said there would be unnerving weather, convulsions, disturbances in the world. And that was the prophecy, that nature was crying out because of the sin that had entered the world. There would be earthquakes. Water and fire would try the globe. And we've seen this, right? From the hurricanes to the areas that are just engulfed in flame. There would be thunderstorms which would shake cities. It would be an unrelenting account. And she went on and on to say, I won't go through all of it, but it does give you pause, doesn't it? It does make you think about the times in which we're living in. It makes you think about the sin that's in the world. You know, nature cries out when Adam and Eve sinned. Disorder entered the world, and that's why we see this. There are many saints, many people around the world who had encountered the perils of storms. St. Scholastica, St. Francis Solanas, you have Father Mazzucchelli, so many different people. Let's call upon the intercession of the saints. Let's do the one thing that we can do that really holds back the hand of God and his justice, that quells these disturbances, that brings peace, that brings unity, and that's pray. We'll do that when I return.